compare it with how much FDI was flowing into Poland, with the amount of budgetary support that was given to Ukraine since the beginning of the war, with the size of frozen Russian assets, $40 billion per year is not a lot of money. It's totally doable.
What's the bill to rebuild Ukraine, and who will pay it? Recently, the journal Economic Policy Papers on European and Global Issues held its first winter conference titled What's Next for Ukraine? 4 years into the war, as the two sides tentatively explore a way to end the conflict, we are bringing you a three-part series based on the papers presented at this conference. I'm Tim Phillips. In this first episode, I'm speaking with Yuri Gorodnichenko and Morris Obstfeld of UC Berkeley about the scale of the challenge, the role of foreign capital inflows, and why investment isn't just about replacing what's been destroyed. It's about shaping Ukraine's long-run growth path.
To paraphrase Churchill, give us the tools and we'll finish the job.
Maury, we're talking about the rebuilding of Ukraine's economy. Apart from the obvious thing that we think about, the repairing the physical damage to Ukraine, what else needs to be done?
Well, we view the problem as putting Ukraine on the development path that other Eastern European countries have followed. And if you look at the data, when communism collapsed, Ukraine, in terms of per capita GDP, was relatively well off within this group of ex-Soviet bloc countries. And over the subsequent decades, it just has not progressed, so that its GDP per capita path has been very low. Even without the war, there was an incredible challenge of development for Ukraine. Now, if the war is going to come to an end, and again, this is something we're very uncertain about and discussing day by day, there is an opportunity for Ukraine to get back on that path that other neighbor countries have navigated more successfully. You know, there are many, 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 many components of that, and we focus particularly on investment, which is an area where Ukraine has not done well compared to its peers, both in terms of domestic investment and, importantly, foreign investment, whether it be direct investment or aid inflows. We view this as absolutely an essential component of growth, as it has been in these other peer countries. For that to happen, we see it as very important that the current accession talks with the EU continue successfully to conclusion, because our analysis, as well as logic, suggests that integration into the European Union single market is going to be a huge boost, not only directly for productivity, but in the willingness of foreign firms to invest in Ukraine. Now, obviously, there are a lot of other components of a successful strategy, which we can talk about. One component is just the investment in business environment, controlling corruption. That's going to be a huge factor. And rebuilding will be huge, but when we look at the capital needs of Ukraine, it's not only rebuilding, but it's keeping up with peers in Eastern Europe that are already in the EU. It's converging toward their levels. And all of that we think is feasible, but it's going to take work.
There has been some stunning success from ex-Soviet states and ex-Eastern Bloc states in their development in the last 30 years, pre-2022. Why was Ukraine not considered a good investment destination?
Now, Ukraine has gone through various cycles in its economic history since the early 90s. Initially, there's a kind of chaotic phase of emerging from the Soviet world, moving to a market economy. When you get to the decade of the 2000s, the first decade of this millennium, Ukraine's actually doing pretty well. Its exports are expanding, agricultural exports in particular. This is also a period when emerging markets everywhere are doing very well. Even Africa, which has lagged behind in many respects, is beginning to show convergence. So, you know, this isn't unique to Ukraine, but it's a good environment for Ukraine. And then with the global financial crisis, a lot of the world slows down, but Ukraine in particular, corruption, cronyism, harassment by Russia, you know, to be frank, that's also a factor, hold it back. And then you get to 2014 and the invasion of Crimea. And then there are very obvious costs in terms of the loss of Crimea, the military occupation in the Donbass, which are serious drags to growth. What we've seen as the world up until now, at least, rallied behind Ukraine is reasons for more hope. Again, the prospect of entering the EU is huge, but also the Ukrainians have demonstrated so much fortitude and ingenuity in developing their defense industry. In particular, it's clear there's a lot of human capital and potential there. With a sufficient influx of capital, there would be strong prospects for growth in the future.
Presuming that there is peace soon, we hope there is, what sort of scale of investment is Ukraine going to need if it is to rebuild?
The main objectives here are to rebuild capital destroyed in the war. That's about $20 billion per year for 10 years. Then stop Ukraine from falling behind its peers, such as Poland, Czechia, and others. That is going to mean another $10 billion per year. And then if we want to start convergence of Ukraine towards Poland, Czechia, and others, we need another $10 billion per year, $40 billion per year. It's a lot of money. On the other hand, it's totally feasible, we think, when you compare it with how much FDI was flowing into Poland, with the amount of budgetary support that was given to Ukraine since the beginning of the war per year, with the size of frozen Russian assets. $40 billion per year is not a lot of money. It's totally doable.
But times change, don't they? How much immediate support could Ukraine expect from its neighbors, for example?
It's truly a $40 billion question. You know, probably when we look at early years after the war, when the country is devastated by the war, the absorptive capacity is not very high. And so maybe we have to rely on funding that comes from institutions like the World Bank and other international financial institutions. And maybe this is going to be enough to cover short-term needs. But eventually, it has to be a combination of public funding from the EU. It doesn't have to be, again, a lot of money, but, you know, some money for sure. Some money through foreign direct investment. Again, it doesn't have to be everything, but part of it. Some of this is going to be covered by domestic savings. Again, not everything, but part of it. So when you kind of add up everything together, it doesn't look an impossible job.
It doesn't look an impossible job, but it seems like one that has to be quite carefully coordinated.
That's for sure. That's for sure. And we have some suggestions about what can be done. You have to work on the domestic banking sector to make sure they can mobilize domestic savings. Ideally, we want to have some type of reconstruction agency that is going to coordinate external funding and do some planning. So there are things we can do even now before the war is over to lay the groundwork for future capital flows.
And one Achilles heel of many aid programs is that the aid flows directly into consumption rather than investment. Sometimes this is consumption by corrupt elites, sometimes not. But consumption at this stage of Ukraine's development is probably not the most effective way to use these resources. And so part of any package will have to be policies that would promote domestic saving rather than consumption. And probably there would be more policies needed to promote FDI directly.
So how can you implement policies for domestic saving rather than consumption in an environment where I imagine a lot of people have deferred their consumption waiting for this moment?
It's a huge challenge. Certainly tax incentives through declining value-added tax could do this. You know, there are many other ways to incentivize saving. The big challenge is, as you say, you know, people have been deferring consumption. Mm-hmm. They're coming out of war, hopefully. And, you know, we saw in the pandemic the power of deferred consumption. We think it's not impossible to do, but clearly you would need to protect the most vulnerable, and that's an imperative. For those people who are living basically hand to mouth, there's not much room for saving, and they have to be protected. But there are other people who are well off who you could have, as it were, bear the brunt of this consumption deferral. You know, they wouldn't be that unhappy to save more. You could also think about targeting specific categories of goods, like luxury goods, that you would certainly want to discourage the importation of or the consumption of.
Corruption has been in the news recently in Ukraine, and it has always been in the background there. If there's a huge amount of investment coming in, then how do we manage that problem?
Obviously, it is a very difficult question, and it's hard to see anything positive from the recent reports about awful corruption happening now. But having said this, you can have an optimistic take on this, at least to some extent. The fact that anti-corruption agencies established, you know, some years ago now prove their effectiveness, that they can go even after very, very highly ranked officials. I would say it's inconceivable that something like this can happen now in the US, but it is definitely happening in Ukraine.
Yeah. You mentioned the EU's role in this and possible joining the EU as a carrot to hold out to Ukraine. Does that have an effect before Ukraine joins the EU?
The evidence we've looked at suggests that, yes, it does, that investors take this as a big signal of future productivity. Now, in the Ukrainian case, then there's obviously a security situation that deters investors. And, you know, we've looked at both at EU accession and NATO accession. NATO accession is incredibly important. And so while EU accession will certainly be important, it's also going to be important to stabilize the security situation in order to bring in investment. And that need not be through joining NATO. There could be other security arrangements, but that will be a big factor going forward.
There's 7 million Ukrainians outside of Ukraine, and many of them are working. The remittances they send back, is this significant in this big number that you're talking about?
So one thing we want to have for Ukraine is to be a country that is not going to rely on remittances to support itself.
Yeah.
So if it is a solution, we would like it to be a temporary solution. That's number one. Number two, it's true Ukraine received a lot of remittances over the years. But now, since people tend to settle in Europe, that the flow of remittances is not as high as it was in the past. And maybe more importantly, remittances are mostly used for consumption. We want to have capital flows that support investment. And for that, FDI is ideal. We want to have this as the main source of funding, not remittances.
Yeah. How do you structure FDI so that it has that investment growth potential?
That's a very good question. There are concerns about some FDI being more productive than other forms of FDI. And we haven't investigated that explicitly. It's a good avenue for thinking about how you might preferentially subsidize some forms of FDI, perhaps with tax-free zones, such as Poland used when it developed. But I do think there has to be some scrutiny of FDI flows. You know, if you just look at data, actually all kinds of things are considered FDI, including funds related to offshore banking and financial arbitrage. And so we just can't take a lot of comfort in aggregate numbers without being much more discerning about what we're really looking at.
In this and other policies, is the model of what happened to Poland, to Czechia, to Hungary, to other similar states, in most cases quite successfully. Is that a model that can now be applied in this very different context?
We think there's a lot of potential. As you indicated, in the past, Ukraine has had a number of factors that have held back growth. But we think that the experience of the war itself, the experience of national solidarity, national pride in the capabilities that have been developed and the ability to hold off Russia for 4 years now are going to be a real force pulling the country forward.
Against that, Ukraine will have a large war debt.
Yes. Well, you know, here's an everything, the lessons of World War I are important.
Oh, dear.
One of the things we learned from the developing country debt crises in the 80s were the about the problem of debt overhang. A big overhang of debt can deter new investment and harm growth. In fact, the effect can be so detrimental that for sufficiently large debts, debt forgiveness can raise the value of what creditors can hope to get returned by the country. So we think for Ukraine, and here the IMF agrees with us, there will have to be a very deep restructuring of external debts, of war debts, taking the form, at the very least, of very long debt extensions, presumably with present value reductions and even face value reductions or forgiveness of debt. Some worry that these kinds of restructurings can deter private investment from coming in. On the contrary, we think that these are an absolute necessity for inducing private investment to come in without fear of expropriation to pay previous debts. Now, the biggest debts are to bilateral official creditors, so they have the capacity to deliver this type of forgiveness. And given that many of them are in Europe, it's going to be very much in their interest to support Ukraine's growth, its ability to defend itself, indeed its ability to serve as a buffer between the rest of Western Europe and Russia.
You've talked about the attributes of Ukraine and Ukrainian people in particular that give you cause for optimism. But we're at a moment now where politically, many people who could help Ukraine might feel that they would like to look the other way or delay their help or perhaps cut back on what they might have promised a couple of years ago. If we do not take this opportunity to rebuild Ukraine, what is the risk both for Ukraine and for the region?
This is a huge second chance for Ukraine. Ukraine is a huge country with vast potential. It has the most military capability on this side of the Urals right now.
Yes.
And there would be an immense benefit to Europe to support it and to help it succeed. Now, if you're the person in the street, you might say, well, it's been 4 years. We're tired of this.
How much more do we have to do?
How much more do we have to do? Now is the time to step up, give Ukraine the resources it needs, and help bring this all to a close. European taxpayers are understandably tired, but there are some other sources of resources out there, notably the reserves that are immobilized in Euroclear, using these reserves for a reparations loan to give Ukraine immediately access to about 200 billion euros in resources, which would really carry it a long way in the fight against Russia. And the Russian economy is under a lot of stress. And the expected return in terms of the war effort to telling Vladimir Putin that this is not going to be over in 6 months, it's not going to be over in 12 months, it's not going to be over in 24 months, that's potentially transformative.
There is this narrative that Ukraine is on the brink of collapse and Russia has all the cards. It's not true. Ukrainian economy has proven to be very resilient. The Russian economy is entering the stage where they have more and more headwinds. They start to feel the pressure of the sanctions and the war. So I don't want to have anybody to have this impression that it's predetermined that Ukraine is going to lose. We can have a very different scenario. And in many ways, it is a choice. If we decide to paraphrase Churchill, give us the tools and we'll finish the job. It's the mood in Ukraine. If you give us enough resources, we can overcome this war. We can defeat Russian aggression. And when you look at the public polls, it's hard to be optimistic after 4 years of the war. 70-80% of people now say that they will be able to continue this war effort for as long as it takes. I find this remarkable.
The two most extensive war machines in Europe are Russia's and Ukraine's. Think about the consequences for Western Europe of those both being under Russian control. It's pretty scary. Europe can't allow that to happen.
Let's hope it doesn't happen. And let's hope that this 40 billion challenge is met in the way that it should be. Thank you very much for talking about it. Thank you, Yuri.
Thank you.
And thank you, Maury.
Thanks, Tim.
The paper is You Only Live Twice, Financial Inflows and Growth in a Westward-Facing Ukraine by Yuri Gorodnichenko and Morris Obstfeld. It was published in the current issue of Economic Policy, Papers on European and Global Issues. That issue's called What's Next for Ukraine? For more on the papers we feature in this series, go to economic-policy.org. Next time on What's Next for Ukraine, if you're building from the ground up, how do you rebuild cities that actually work in the 21st century?
This was a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer was Megan Bieber, and the sound editor was Andrei Zargarian.